This is Jim Inkster. Thanks for joining us for Talk Louisiana, signature support from the office of the East Baton Rouge Parish Mayor, President. And the show originates from the Investar Tower in Baton Rouge, and we're joined now by His Honor Smiley Gray Anders, who on June 4th celebrates 45 years as a six-day-a-week columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate. His column has produced more words than any entity in the history of the newspaper of record in Louisiana. And congratulations on making it another year, Smiley Anders.
Well, thank you so much, Jim. That's awfully nice.
And back in the day, when you were approached about doing this, you were working at the paper, and Smiley, for those of us who know him, he writes features, and he used to write them prolifically, but he had many talents. He could have gone in any direction, and I suspect there was probably a little skepticism when they said, hey, we're going to do this items column, and you're the person.
Oh, absolutely. When they first asked me, I thought they meant something to do beside my business beat. And I said, well, geez, guys, I'm very busy with that. I don't know how much time, extra time I'm going to have. They said, no, we want you to do it every day. And well, actually, so 3 days a week. We eventually expanded to five and then six. And I said, you mean every day I'm supposed to do this? They said, well, yeah, based on Herb Cade's column, which ran for 50 years in the San Francisco Chronicle, and it was a daily items column. And I said, yeah, well, I'll give it a shot. But I was always ready to go back to covered business where this didn't work. And it seems to have worked, over the years.
I would say that's an understatement. And when the Advocate and the Picayune merged, I think many thought, well, the New Orleans audience will never embrace Smiley the way the Baton Rouge audience has. But they were wrong. You have a whole set of followers, don't you?
One of my elders said when they bought the paper, they had no idea the column even existed. They were, and then when they got, started going through everything, they realized a lot of the readers had liked the column, and when it moved to New Orleans, it wasn't supposed to work down there, but everybody picked up on it pretty well. And now I would say I get at least as much or probably more stuff out of the New Orleans area, including the North Shore, and than I do the Baton Rouge area. So, mm-hmm. Of course, Acadiana. But it's been encouraging. And New Orleans people have some crazy stories too. Almost everybody in New Orleans has some crazy.
I don't think there's any doubt. But when John Georges purchased the paper, a good man who I think has done a good job in a tough environment owning the newspaper of record, and good thing we have a newspaper in Baton Rouge and New Orleans, but it went from local ownership here in Baton Rouge, the manships for several decades, almost a century, I think, and then it goes to this guy who's a New Orleanian. I thought, uh-oh, but what did he say first time you met him?
He's just a very genial guy, and he pretty much told me in so many words, just keep doing what you're doing. So I said, well, yeah, I could do that, because we already had it pretty well established. I had a good bunch of readers who were writing the column for me, and so all I do is sit back and edit it and let the readers have at it, which is the idea of the column anyhow.
It started June 4th, 1979, and that was a few months before the hostages were taken in Iraq. Iran. And you survived that and the elections that have followed. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected president, and Pat Screen was elected mayor of Baton Rouge, and of course in 79 it was David Treen who was elected governor. You've seen a lot of stuff come and go. What's been the biggest epiphany you've had as far as our world at large since you started writing the column?
I don't write about politics. Of course, I, like every other citizen, I watch it, and it's been really discouraging the way we've moved to the right in such an extreme manner. On the fringe state, it's just, it really, really, we've just kind of become Saudi Arabia West, an oppressive regime supported by the oil industry. And so, other than that, we're fine, you know.
The other day I was talking about how Clay Higgins was extremely popular in Acadiana, and I meant with the electorate as a whole, but I got some messages from listeners in Lafayette who said, we don't like him at all. Well, we do have a legitimate counter viewpoint, but it's not enough to win many elections when it comes to statewide offices or even regional offices like Congress. And this is a departure from the old days when Democrats ruled the roost. But Smiley, Gus Weil, our friend now departed, he once said it moves in cycles. But this may be a long cycle.
I'm hoping it does. I'm hoping we can. It could get a whole lot worse in November. I mean, it could get. We're pretty much doomed if that election didn't go the right way. And I say that in all levity, without somebody like Hunter Thompson, we will indeed be doomed. So, but on a cheerful note,
let's hope things work out better for you and me than they did for Hunter, who was a brilliant guy. But as you note.
Yeah.
In your columns every day, sometimes the most talented people, sometimes the most enlightened people are extremely troubled. And Hunter, obviously, as it ended, he was a man who had some issues.
He did. You could tell he was not. Of course, I understand he did some drugs, too, so that could have had some effect.
Yeah, and I'm laughing, but now in the old days, you might do drugs and then hurt yourself as Hunter did and do the ultimate act. But this opioid stuff, that's one of the things now. Over 100,000 people in this country die of opioid overdoses.
Yeah.
And this is not black kids in impoverished neighborhoods. It's people all over the spectrum.
Yeah, we thought the problem was going to be crack, and it's gone way, way beyond that now. So it's discouraging, and I don't know what would motivate somebody to do that. Fortunately, I've had a really charmed life, and never, other than a martini on occasion, that's about it. That's what I do.
Did you ever smoke, Smiley?
That was a day of my life, and I'm down with a lung disease, so which is kind of ironic, but not funny. But never did. Never got to have it. And when everybody else had smoked, the newsroom was always had a cloud over it. They smoked not only cigarettes, but cigars, pipes. And I was damn near the only one who didn't smoke.
You got a lot of passive smoke, though. But you're now.
I did.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, that's what my doctor said. It was secondhand smoke was what got me, I think.
But you're 86 years old, and you're still obviously vibrant, and you know what's happening, and you've got a lung condition. But if you had smoked, I imagine we would be visiting you in a cemetery somewhere.
Oh, yeah, you visited me probably 20 years ago. My doctor said I was really fortunate that I never smoked, because as bad as it is now, and I'm on oxygen, and that's why I'm not getting around very much. I got a hollow tank around. But he said if I smoked, it would have been much earlier.
Now, journalists on the whole don't do as well, I think, in relationships as other people, and part of it's the nature of the job, and I think part of it's the kind of people who gravitate to be journalists, but you had a few misfires along the way, but you found your soulmate, didn't you?
I did. It did. I kissed a lot of frogs along the way until I found the princess. And now Catherine, and actually I'm very lucky because Catherine and her sister Valerie is living with us now. And between the two of them, they take such good care of me. It's kind of embarrassing. I kind of sit here and wait to be served, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of really great what they've gone through just to keep me up and around. You know, they just really watch me and, you know, make sure I'm not falling or anything like that. So I'm very, very fortunate to have this, of course, working, works for the state with nursing homes, trying to help people in nursing homes. So she very, very much like social work and devoted to helping others, including me. Very, very fortunate.
Well, Smiley, it is always an honor to talk with you, and we'll be back with more Talk Louisiana after this brief timeout of 89.3 seconds. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana on Memorial Day, and we'll return in just a moment with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and our guest is Joyce Lee Malcolm, professor at George Mason University School of Law, the author of Guns and Violence, Peter's War, To Keep and Bear Arms, and The Tragedy of Benedict Arnold. And she is back in a huge way with The Times That Try Men's Souls. It is a remarkable story about the formative years of our country, and it's been ballyhooed, justifiably so, as a compelling, intimate, and thought-provoking history of the Revolutionary period through a series of charismatic and enterprising families. And Dr. Malcolm, you note that this was largely, in many ways, a civil war. The Revolutionary War is not often depicted that way, but you lay out the case pretty convincingly.
Yes, thank you. When I told people I was writing about families divided during the war, everyone assumed that I was writing about the Civil War.
Well, you examine Benedict Arnold, who has been vilified as the worst American of all time, but he did bad things, but you say he was a complex historical figure. Why?
He was a brilliant general. The author of the classic work on the British Army says that Arnold was the best general on either side during the Revolutionary War, and he risked his life on one battlefield after another, but he lived to be vilified by a lot of other people and eventually changed sides. But because of him, we really won that war. So he was complex, and I was able to get into a lot of the factors that persuaded him to abandon the American side.
What were the major factors for that to happen?
Well, he had a series of enemies, and he was not one who tolerated fools easily. He was not a diplomat, unlike Washington, who was able to deal with Congress whenever they were unpleasant. And the other thing was that early in the war, he led a group up through the wilderness of Maine to meet with another American army coming from Montreal, and they were to attack Quebec. Going through the wilderness of Maine turned out to be a real horror, with having to carry their boats through swamps and having very little food. And at the end of it, they attacked Quebec during a snowstorm, and he was wounded, and they spent the winter outside Quebec. But the Congress kept telling him that they had loaned him money for that campaign, and he needed to account for every penny. And here he was in the hospital there, the field hospital, saying, please send me, you know, an accountant, but they didn't. So even after all of that, they kept on with how much he owed them. And later on in the war, he got attacked by some of the radical Americans in the street in Philadelphia. And he was never able to pay back this, the Congress reckoned, some thousand marks or pounds of that they owed him. So and also, I guess there was the British sort of persuaded people, and he wasn't the only one who changed sides, that it would end the war more quickly and blood would be spared if, you know, he came over, which he did. But it's rather sad that he's been kind of demoted to just kind of a two-dimensional cardboard character, because he really was very brave and instrumental in our winning.
The Quincy family, major players, and you bring them to life.
Yes, there were two sons who, the father, Josiah Sr., was very much a patriot, but his older son, Samuel, was a lawyer and was made the Solicitor General of the colony of Massachusetts. His younger brother, Josiah Jr., was quite a hothead and a member of the Sons of Liberty and wrote a whole lot of pamphlets about whatever was the cause at that moment, how the Americans should reach for their swords and plunge them into the hearts of their enemies. So these two brothers were really on opposite sides. And eventually, the older brother, Samuel, decides to go into exile in England, leaving his wife and three children, who were patriotic, to be taken in by her brother, who lived in Cambridge. And he never saw his children again. He thought that this was, a lot of these exiles thought they were going for their safety to England and they would be back soon and certainly the English would win the war. And it ended up that they were in England for a long time and after a couple of years of war, mm-hmm. they were banished. They could not come back and their property was sold at auction. And so families John Adams's best friend, Jonathan Sewall. His wife had a sister who was married to John Hancock. And the one sister was in exile in England, and the other sister was married to Hancock. And they corresponded. But, you know, there's just this sadness of families who had been able to kind of tiptoe around differences, and suddenly now they were forced to, you know, take different sides. The exiles ended up, most of them, going to Canada after the war and sort of settling those Atlantic provinces, while the remaining Americans who had been faithful and risked fighting this huge empire took, you know, courage and started a new government where they could preserve their rights. And John Adams says to his wife in a letter, he says, "Posterity, you will never know how much it costs the present generation to preserve your freedom." And my aim was really to try and understand what it did cost that generation.
In The Times That Try Men's Souls, Joyce Lee Malcolm traces the origins and experiences of the division during the American Revolution. How bad was it?
It was quite bad. There were a lot of people who simply were intimidated into keeping their heads down and, you know, trying to not get in the way of their neighbors. The lieutenant governor, Thomas Hutchinson, had a mob that was raised by the Sons of Liberty, some 3,000 people, and they attacked his house. He had a beautiful house. He had been, you know, going along with the Stamp Act, but he hadn't really done anything in particular. He was the lieutenant governor. His family just got out of that house before the mob came, and they had hatchets, and they broke in the doors. They stole or destroyed everything inside. They even broke down the partition walls and took the slates off the roof and cut down all his trees. I mean, the kind of anger that upset these people was amazing. And the fact was that once the Sons of Liberty and others got a mob going, it's very hard to stop it. And a lot of the other people who had agreed to be working for the government with the Stamp Act, you know, obviously just refused to do any more. It worked. That violence worked. But it was at a cost that a lot of, you know, sort of well-meaning people who might have been able to get together and come up with some, you know, peaceful means of getting, you know, their differences settled, you know, were driven into exile. It's, you know, really unfortunate. I should say that one of the lines that I thought was very poignant was that Thomas Jefferson, in his first iteration of the Declaration of Independence, says, "We might have been a free and a great people together." And you sort of feel like the opportunities for that to happen got lost because people just became so intransigent.
Well, it is amazing that George Washington prevailed with all the obstacles, both from within and from the great power of the king.
Washington was an amazing man. I mean, it was after the war when he surrendered his commission to Congress. The king said, you know, if he does that, he will be the greatest man alive. Washington was not seeking power. and patient with Congress, something that Benedict Arnold was not. Congress was always worried that the Army would become a special class and would prey on the people, even their own Army. And so they kind of kept Washington and the Army on a short leash. And he put up with a lot from them. And, you know, he's so impressive. He's one of those people, the more you know about him, the more impressive, you know, you can see that he was. So we were very fortunate in having Washington. We didn't have something like Napoleon in the French Revolution. We had someone who was a really stellar patriot.
Well, thank you for joining us, Joyce Lee Malcolm. Fascinating book, The Times, the Tri-Men Souls, the Adams, the Quincys, and the Battle for Loyalty in the American Revolution. It is quite a read. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
Next up on Talk Louisiana, another author with a book about a war. This one regards the Civil War, from Tim Wendell, one of the best storytellers of them all. This is Jim Inkster, and you are listening to Talk Louisiana, and our guest is Tim Wendell, writer in residence at Johns Hopkins University, one of the great institutions of higher learning in the country, and he is the author of The Summer of 68, Cancer Crossings, High Heat, and the historical novels Castro's Curveball and its sequel Escape from Castro's Cuba. His latest work is Rebel Falls, and good morning to you, Tim Wendell.
Good morning, Jim.
Well, this one, you go back a lot farther than 1968. We're back to 1864, and as we know, there was something called the Civil War, which was raging. Tell us more.
Oh, yes. There was pretty much the Civil War was somewhat coming down the home stretch, Jim, but I discovered these, which I never knew about. I grew up near the Canadian border, but there were Confederate spies, actually Union spies, all along the border, from the Maritimes all the way to Detroit, and I'm focusing on one episode where they nearly seized the only remaining Union warship on the Great Lakes, and they were looking to create havoc with it on the eve of the presidential election with Abraham running for re-election in late 1864. So that's the backdrop, and this was a lot of fun to do.
Well, General Sherman, the first president of LSU, by the way, he's marching on Atlanta. That didn't go so well for the South. And the armies of Grant and of Lee are battling across Virginia. But you find this nugget that has great relevance north of the Mason-Dixon line. How pivotal was it?
It could have been very pivotal, Jim, because one thing I didn't know, and I think it's not explained that well, at least in the textbooks where I went to high school and even to college, is that, again, you had this whole espionage and spy network along the Canadian border. Why are they there? Well, in a sense, especially from the Confederate side, they were desperate. As you say, Sherman's marching through Georgia to the sea. Things are locked up in Virginia between Lee and Grant. The Confederates are desperate for something to tip the balance, and in a sense, get maybe recognition finally from Europe, especially Great Britain. And in a sense, this area, this front, was called a world on fire because it nearly ignited the First World War and nearly brought in England, nearly brought in France is looking at it, etc. And it was pretty amazing that they were looking for one spark, one international incident that in a sense would bring other forces in, perhaps save the Confederacy, and in doing so, really open up another front for the Union that would really cause a lot of difficulty for Lincoln and Grant.
Well, you note in Rebel Falls that the Confederates' plan was to seize the USS Michigan on Lake Erie and then bombard Buffalo, Cleveland, and perhaps other so-called northern cities. This would have been cataclysmic, wouldn't it?
Very much, because as history busts know, pretty much all the Union forces were down in the siege of Petersburg at that point, outside of Richmond. And besides bombarding on the eve of the presidential election, where war fatigue has just been playing out, especially in the North, you've got the Copperheads looking to make peace and recognize a Confederate nation. Besides bombarding those on the eve of the election, they were looking to release prisoners from an area called Johnson's Island, which was right near Sandusky. These were some of the top prisoners from Gettysburg and such, and they were positioned way up north because the Union officials felt that there would be no threat to escape. But if they had seized the Michigan, they certainly would have been. And combating this was Secretary Seward and Stanton from the Secretary of War Stanton put together a very makeshift a network of spies on the Union side. And that's where I had a lot of fun with a character called Rory Chase, who's mm-hmm. kind of a composite of several different folks from the Union side, and suddenly had to go, in a sense, combat these Confederate spies that were really much farther along, both in plans and in money.
Well, we're going to get to Rory, a compelling figure and a person that has not only come through the imagination of our guest, Tim Wendell, but has relevance to that time. Now, what about the plan, if it had been successful? This was an election year. 1864 is like 2024, 160 years ago, so that means we were 40 elections ago for president. I would imagine that if the South had been successful, it would have affected that election, wouldn't it?
Very much so. I think, it's easy now to look back and say, well, Lincoln decisively won re-election, beating McClellan, the former Union general, George McClellan, decisively in the Electoral College. But at this point in time, as the election's now on the horizon, when the Confederates are looking to seize again this very impressive warship, 160 feet long, iron hull, great deal of armament on it, the Union, again, was, wore out in terms of war, had war fatigue. And really, even within Lincoln's cabinet, there was real disagreement. Would Lincoln even win re-election? Lincoln himself is going, well, it's probably 50-50. Mm-hmm. Seward, his Secretary of State, is going, no, I think we're going to edge it out. Whereas others like Stanton and such said, no, I think we may lose, in a sense, because the war had gone on so long. And this is one reason why I think the South was so effective, is they didn't really have to take over territory necessarily. What they had to do was stretch the war out long enough for the Union, to the North, to get tired of it, just be wore out, perhaps to bring in a European power like Great Britain. So the stakes were very, very high, which is something, again, when you look back at the history, you go, oh, we won, like, I believe it's 212 to some meager number over McClellan. Well, it was thought to be much closer than that in the days and weeks leading up to the election itself, when the Michigan, the battleship, was very much in play.
Our guest is Tim Wendell. The book is Rebel Falls, a historical novel. Tell us about Rory Chase, a protagonist who is a haunted young woman and really a compelling figure in your book.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Jim. I wanted, as I said, Rory's a composite. The Confederate spies are very much based on real individuals, whereas Rory is somebody, as you say, haunted. Her mother had been involved in the Underground Railroad in the years leading up to the war. And I was going, I need a character here that, in a sense, really brings together both the frustration and the fear that's going on in the North at this point in time. So I would love to have somebody who's very much in the Seward inner circle. Why the Seward family? Well, William Seward's the Secretary of State, arguably the second most powerful person in the North after Abraham Lincoln. He's one of folks who remember goes on and buys Alaska from the Russians, and it's called Seward's Folly and such. So a very dynamic guy, guy who's very much, taking everything by the horns and going with it. So I wanted somebody who could get us inside there. So Secretary Seward had one daughter, Fanny Seward. And I started thinking, what if we had a childhood friend who's very much different than Fanny, but they grew up together, they know each other. And so therefore, that's a way for Rory Chase to be very close to the Seward family, both in Auburn, New York, where they're from, and also down in Washington, D.C., where much of the end of Rebel Falls plays out. But then I started going, okay, well, I went back and forth, could we even do like a boyfriend of Fanny, something like that. But as you well know, if you were a male in the Civil War and decided on either side, I've got, patriotic fever, I'm going to join either side, you probably have no problem. Yeah, sign up, away you go. You might be dead in a couple of weeks because of the way they were just mowing down people. So I wanted then to have a woman. And I kind of went, were women that involved? And I stumbled across the great case of a woman named Sarah Edmonds out of Michigan, who disguised herself as a man and actually joined the 2nd Infantry out of Michigan. And the more research I did, I found all these women on both sides, Belle Boyd, et cetera, you know, spies, disguised soldiers, who were very much involved in the conflict. And at that point, that empowered me to really make Rory a real heroine, so to speak, and somebody I hope readers are rooting for in Rebel Falls.
Rebel Falls is the book from Tim Wendell, who lives in Charlottesville, Virginia, a historical city and one that has had some relevance of late. You write like you're a Civil War buff. You obviously, if you didn't know a lot about the war before, you know much about it now. Was this a Johnny-come-lately endeavor, or have you been on this trail for a long time?
Oh, kind of a little bit of both, Jim. I've always been a Civil War buff. Was I an expert on it? No, and I don't profess to be maybe one now either, but I still remember my grandfather taking me to Gettysburg for the first time. I think I was like 10 or 11, and that really was a mind opener. But what was interesting about Rebel Falls, Jim, was, you know, I think we're taught one way about the Civil War. And I love, you know, overturning, you know, things that haven't been looked at before. And once I found these two Confederate spies who are real life guys, John Yates Bell, who went to the University of Virginia for a while here in Charlottesville, a guy named Bennett Burley, who was a soldier of fortune from Scotland, and what success they had had first on the Chesapeake Bay, and then the plans that they were and the schemes that they had hatched on the Great Lakes. I went, wow, I've never really heard of these folks. And they're only mentioned in passing in books like Doris Kearns Goodwin's Team of Rivals, and even a little bit in Carl Sandburg's Lincoln. But then to burrow down deeper and do more research on those two individuals. In fact, I went all the way to London to the British Library and found out great material about Bennett Burley. So you put them in play, and then you bring in a character that, yeah, is made up, but a composite of real life ones, and Rory Chase. And at that point, I knew I was onto something. So at least on that front, I was a Johnny come lately.
Well, congratulations on a gripping novel that has real life consequences then and now. It is Rebel Falls from Tim Wendell. It's been a pleasure, Tim.
Thank you, Jim.
You're listening to Talk Louisiana, and we'll be back for our final quarter hour with the incomparable Lee Steinberg, one of the top sports agents of all time here on Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Inkster. We're joined now by Lee Steinberg. He was with us a few months ago, and we got lots of positive response, so he's back. Perhaps the most profound and prolific sports agent in American history. Also a philanthropist and an author, and during a 41-year career, Lee Steinberg represented over 300 professional athletes in football, baseball, basketball, boxing, and Olympic sports. He's represented the number one pick in the NFL draft a record 8 times, and he's joining us from California, and it was a quarterback from the University of Southern California who was the first player taken in this year's NFL draft, Caleb Williams. I read the other day, Lee, that the average salary in the NFL is $750,000 a year. That's the average. And it is a case in which people are making money that we would have never thought of years ago. But now I would suspect that Caleb Williams will be a millionaire many times over before he ever throws a pass.
I would guess that his bonus would be somewhere in the range of $25 million. Which would be paid up front. Now, this actually was my 50th draft last night because I started in 1975. And to give you a contrast, quarterback Steve Bartkowski picked number one overall by the Atlanta Falcons in 1975, got a stunning package that made headlines. It was $600,000 total for 4 years, and he got a $250,000 signing bonus. So, yes, there's been an exponential explosion in revenue in sports. to be able to show the Monday through Friday programming promos on Sunday afternoon. And the when I say loss leader, means that the amount of money they spend for rights fees to networks is so much higher than the return, but it allows them the network build, and that adds to the billions of dollars bottom line. So as long as sports continues to draw record numbers, 130 million people watch the Super Bowl, then this will never end. And then you have new revenue in stadia and arenas and luxury boxes and naming rights. You now have fantasy sports, merchandising memorabilia. You now have gambling, where you can walk into the Washington Commander Stadium and place a bet. If anything, revenue is going to continue to accelerate.
You mentioned gambling. And the Washington Commanders, who took LSU's Jaden Daniels with the second pick, and Daniels is one of those people who ended up with 5 years of activity as a result of COVID and stayed in college a long time and became a millionaire along the way while he was playing collegiately. That's changed a bit. Now players can do well as collegiate athletes as far as their paychecks.
Yeah, it was sort of amazing watching LSU last night, because they start with the quarterback and then they have two first-round wide receivers picked. NIL has changed dramatically the whole nature of athletic branding, the age, the whole concept that now someone would be 15 years old and put together a website or put together a way to brand themselves. And then hire at 15 or 16, you know, the next Jaden Daniels will hire a marketing agent. And then that money is used both in recruiting players from high school to college and then again in the transfer portal. So all of a sudden you have money as an outside factor in collegiate sports. And from my standpoint, in terms of representation, instead of me talking to a junior in college at earliest or a senior, someone a little more mature at 21 or 22, if you don't sign the 15-year-old, then and a marketing agent who also represents athletes does, then all of a sudden you've got the no opportunity ever to talk to him.
It is amazing that the money is prolific for college athletes, and gambling has infiltrated the collegiate ranks too. These entities are partnering with universities. LSU was even pushing gambling to its students, and it is illegal in this state to gamble if you're under the age of 21, and most of the students are under the age of 21. But what about the prospect for scandal? We're seeing this, and I don't think the story is over regarding Shohei Ohtani. This would seem to be a recipe for disaster to have gambling so prolific and so available. Your thoughts, Lee?
There was an impregnable wall between the concept of gambling, gamblers, the places where gambling happens. For the whole history of sports, until a Supreme Court case a couple years ago in New Jersey knocked down restrictions, and now we have 32 states that have gambling. The dangers are twofold. The biggest threat to professional sports ever would be the concept that the games are not real contests, they're not played on even playing field, they're fixed. And that could happen a couple different ways. And we've seen them both recently. The first is a athlete who owes so much money to a bookie that he's tempted to shave performance. In other words, just not play as hard or well or absent himself from a game. And the second is inside information. So in the case of the basketball player who just got banned, it was inside information. So there's a thing called a prop bet where in a game you can try to predict whether or not the performance, minutes played, points scored, assists, whatever it would be, will be over or under a certain number. And Jonte Parker came out of two games early, which indicated it would be the under, and all this money came flooding in for the under and from gamblers. And so that was inside information. And this is one of these changes that occurred, and there weren't enough protections to anticipate the unexpected consequences. And so if fans ever thought that the games were fixed, then it would turn into an exhibition like wrestling. So this is about as big a threat to sport as there could be. Mm-hmm. And we tell every athlete not to gamble.
But sometimes they do, as we know. LSU had a player who did it the receiver, Kayshon Boutte, and he, of course, went way in the hole. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars wage, and this was a college student. And I misspoke earlier. The minimum salary in the NFL, minimum salary is $750,000. And as we know, we've got some players making over $50 million. One of those is Aaron Rodgers, and the New York Times a few days ago had a profile of him and how he's now an authority on just about everything known to man and is using his platform. And of course, you're a University of California guy. He went there, played brilliantly for the Golden Bears in his day. But is this a new phenomenon, or has this always been the case to some extent where a prominent athlete is suddenly brilliant about everything in the world?
Fairly new. It came up during the whole issue of players of controversial police shootings, but that was pretty single issue. It was just about that. It wasn't a broad spectrum of. If I remember that Robert Kennedy Jr. floated Aaron Rodgers' name as a vice presidential candidate. No, I'd say he's the most outspoken athlete. Now, there are plenty of athletes fighting for better conditions in the inner city. There are athletes fighting for equal opportunity. But those are pretty non-controversial issues, and Aaron Rodgers is a unique personality.
He is, and arguably one of the two or three greatest quarterbacks of all time. When you look at the numbers he put up playing in Green Bay, he didn't have a dome stadium like Drew Brees or Peyton Manning. He was doing it in Green Bay. He was a real deal as a player, but as a knowledgeable person about vaccines and other matters, I wouldn't take what he says to the bank, and I don't think Lee would either. Well, Lee Steinberg, it is always an honor and pleasure to catch up with you, and we're glad you're in the game and you have joined us today. I appreciate your insights.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana on Memorial Day. Back tomorrow, same time, same place. Until then, thanks for listening. Stay safe. Stay tuned.